Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. The fallout from the explosive Pandora Papers continues. The largest investigation in journalism history, the Pandora Papers expose a shadow financial system that benefits the world's most rich and powerful and fuels inequality around the globe. Over 600 journalists from 150 media outlets in 117 countries contributed to this massive investigation. They reviewed nearly 12 million leaked documents from 14 offshore services. They looked at secret offshore affairs of 35 world leaders, including current and former presidents and prime ministers, and more than 300 public officials in more than 90 countries. Joining us with the latest is Kevin Hall, a Pulitzer Prize winning reporter and North American editor for the Organized Crime and Corruption Reporting Project. Kevin is overseeing the investigations in the United States, Canada, and Mexico. Hi, Kevin. Thanks so much for joining us again.
Thanks for having me back.
Great to have you back. Ziva Brandstetter is the Washington Post corporate accountability team editor. Ziva's team broke the news about Donald Trump steering business to his D.C. hotel and other businesses. And this year, she led dozens of Washington Post journalists working on the Pandora Papers investigation. Hi, Ziva. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Well, great to have you. Well, Ziva, in one of your recent newsletters, you wrote that you have edited and written investigative stories for the past three decades, the past 3 years for the Washington Post. And you write that helping to guide reporters as they search through almost 12 million documents was the most difficult investigative challenge you have ever encountered. So tell us more. What was this experience like for you?
I think what made it so difficult is that the documents, as they came in, roughly 12 million of them were not indexed. There were only about 4% of the documents were what they call structured, easily searchable, easy to analyze. And so it was really like in the column, I compared it to being in a small boat and being out in the middle of an ocean and having no tools to show you where the fish are. We spent some fruitless months just searching through the documents, trying to make sense of them, trying to find things that would be important to our readers. It wasn't enough just to say, hey, all these wealthy people have money stashed offshore, because, of course, that's legal and not surprising. We wanted to find stories that exposed the harm that the system can do to people, especially the powerless and, you know, exacerbating wealth inequality, things like that. So it was really just sorting through all of that at first that was the most difficult and making sense of it.
Right. And Kevin, you touched on this on our Friday show, but what would you add? I mean, Wired magazine even had an entire piece just about how you all unraveled the contents, because again, we're talking about so much data here.
Well, the unsung heroes here are ICIJ's data team that takes this, and I suspect the Washington Post as well was part of this, taking this massive amount of data and structuring it, trying to make it searchable. I can tell you, having been involved in four projects now, ICIJ has a tremendous team that's kind of learned from each one and then made it a little more usable each time. So as a user of this database and being able to go in and access it now, a reporter could go in and limit the search to say, I wanted to look at one of the 14 service providers, AABOL, for instance, in Seychelles. But I didn't want to look at all the spreadsheets. I just wanted to look at PDFs. Certain kind of documents tell you certain kinds of things, and you can kind of get that minute in your search. And that's quite an accomplishment when you're dealing with that many documents. It allows you to do things in a way that's much more time effective. Nobody's going to get through 12. You need 10 lifetimes to get through 12 million documents, but you can, through search terms and through kind of tricks like that. Most people don't know if you have a passport, you have a little thing at the bottom that identifies your three letters that identify your country. It's P less than sign, and then your country, USA, Canada, CAN, Well, each partner could then search for passports in their in that kind of smart way. And then that tells you, it's kind of hard to say, oh, well, you know, I didn't know. Well, if your passport's in there, you kind of knew. So a lot of good tricks that you can do to ease the search, but all of that made possible through excellent arrangement of the data.
It also speaks to the importance of really spending money on investigative journalism, because in this Wired piece, Pierre Romera, chief technology officer of the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists, said the first challenge was for us to get the data. He said we exchanged for weeks and months with the sources, and at a point we had to find a way to get the data. Initially, the ICIJ brokered a deal with sources that would allow them to send the data remotely without needing to travel, but as the size of the document dump grew, so did the challenges in ensuring it could be sent to a secure server. So just the not just ensuring that the data was sent securely, Kevin, took months, which again just speaks to the importance of investing in this kind of investigative journalism.
Yeah, I mean, none of this is cheap. My own organization has a system called Aleph, which is available to journalists under certain terms, but both ICIJ and OCCRP have done a great job of working with reporters around the world to try to make this data accessible. It's not open to the public, in part because a lot of this stuff has passport numbers, bank account numbers, all kinds of personal information that, you know, we're, I think all of us are very conscientious about what we publish in terms of personal details. That's why the public can't look in, but Ziva would know this better than me. I think there will soon enough be a public version of this that has some of that underlying data stripped out, where they can do that, where the public can actually go in and look at some of these things too.
And Ziva, what can you tell us about the Washington Post decision to get involved with this? Because I just want to read some of the headlines. I mean, you all put together so many packages with incredible graphics. A couple of the pieces: Cambodia wants its religious artifacts returned, dozens tied to indicted collector remain in the Met, foreign money secretly floods U.S. tax havens, some of it is tainted. Just a couple more: rogue Americans stashed assets offshore, eluding victims and impeding investigators. Incredible, again, graphics. And this one is absolutely amazing: Bitter Sugar, how money has flowed from the sugar fields of the Dominican Republic to the burgeoning tax haven of South Dakota. And again, amazing graphics, amazing photographs. It's all interactive. Can you just talk about the Washington Post decision to get involved in this project?
Sure. You know, one of the key reporters on this project, Debbie Sensiper, you know, she's a good investigative reporter. She got wind that something was going on, that ICIJ had maybe some kind of new trove of documents late last year. And to make a long story short, she had lunch with, you know, the head of ICIJ, Gerard Ryle, and you know, just impressed upon him that we would love to hear more about it, something that aligned with our work on corporate accountability. And there were discussions at the top of our organization, at the top of ICIJ. At this time, Marty Baron was still leading the post, to ensure that how these documents were obtained and the documents themselves and the project as a whole met our editorial standards at the Post. I am not privy to the exact details of like how ICIJ obtained this material, but I can tell you that our legal team and our top editors were very assured and certain that our involvement in this project met the Post editorial standards. So we eagerly signed on as the U.S. partner for this. The Miami Herald and Kevin and his reporters were also reporting aspects of the U.S., you know, involvement and Latin American involvement in the Pandora Papers. And at its height, we had more than 60 journalists at the Post working on this. But for most of the year, it was a small group of reporters, editors, a couple of editors, and, you know, a photographer that were slogging away, making sense, untangling all these records.
Oh, well, huge thanks to your team, because these pieces are really incredible. And we're going to talk more in depth about a few of them throughout the show. Kevin, since you have been involved in these investigations for years, I mean, we had you on talking about the Panama Papers, which in 2016 uncovered the offshore finance industry. Over 11.5 million leaked documents came out. Again, it created just a mass of incredible stories. Can you connect the dots between the Panama Papers and now the Pandora Papers?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's been a series of leak type things that ICIJ has led. OCRP has done its own with like Open Lux, where you've got these collaborative things. So basically, secrecy is getting harder. Information's getting out there. What the difference with the Pandora Papers is, I think it is partly the scale. I mean, the number of documents isn't wildly more than the Panama Papers, but the distinction is there are 14 service providers. So the Panama Papers was Mossack Fonseca, a single offshore provider. The Paradise Papers, which followed that, was largely Applebee's, a large Caribbean provider, English-speaking provider. And then you had the FinCEN files that BuzzFeed was involved with, which was suspicious activity reports from banks reporting about a lot of these offshore companies. So there's kind of been an evolution. And now this is the largest in terms of scale because there are 14 service providers around the globe. So it covers Hong Kong, it covers the Seychelles, it covers, you know, and then as the Washington Post did a wonderful job highlighting trusts, you know, the United States itself is an offshore haven for people who are looking to hide their money through trusts in South Dakota. So I think in terms, it's an evolution in one way, but in another way, it also allows you to kind of build. So people we looked at in the Panama Papers, but we couldn't quite close the circle. An example is the Odebrecht, that big Brazilian engineering company that was convicted of bribing all across the Americas. The former president of Peru committed suicide as the authorities closed in on him about Odebrecht scandal, et cetera. We were able to close some circles just this week based on a document in the Pandora Papers that was building on those earlier leaks that allowed us to get to a bank. Without getting into detail, we were able to find a bank document that then closed everything, put it all together. So it's a long way of answering your question to say that it's an important evolutionary building block. Each one of these is built on the other.
Let's talk about the fallout from the Panama Papers and then what strikes you about the response to the Pandora Papers. Brooke Harrington, a professor at Dartmouth who researches offshore banking, wrote a piece in the New York Times and wrote that so little has changed after the Panama Papers and the Paradise Papers is not lost on the public. According to her count, there have been fewer than 10 convictions resulting from previous offshore leaks, and only one involved a politician. So, Kevin, what stands out for you when you think about the fallout from the Panama Papers and then the Paradise Papers?
I'm not as negative about that because I think that reference to the convictions are here in the States, I believe. I think around the world there have been quite a bit of things that have happened. You know, you've had Congress finally created a somewhat registry of beneficial owners. Not perfect, but at least it's a start towards really finding, kind of ending the anonymity. And so that something has happened here. States that we wrote about in the Panama Papers, Nevada and Wyoming, changed their laws as a result of the reporting. I suspect after the Washington Post ICIJ reporting that South Dakota and some of the other states may do the same and change, you know, look at their laws and make changes. So I think things have happened. The European, the Commonwealth, British Commonwealth nations have agreed on a registry of beneficial owners. Not perfect. Enforcement isn't perfect. But things, you know, I think things have moved somewhat in the right direction. But I think what this shows is what we shouldn't be a surprise, and what everybody thought when you peel back the curtain where nobody's looking, bad things happen. I mean, that's why sunlight is the best disinfectant, to quote an often quoted cliche.
Right. Ziva, what would you add about the fallout?
Yeah, I mean, you pointed to the 10 convictions, but just because something is legal doesn't mean that it's right. So, you know, the Panama Papers, the Paradise Papers, and now the Pandora Papers all expose financial structures that exist in sort of a gray area where very wealthy and very powerful people, you know, you had leaders on five continents. You had 14 current country leaders whose holdings were exposed in this leak. Technically, what they were doing was legal. They were, you know, the offshore system allows people to choose the laws that they want to follow. And you and I pretty much have to follow the laws of our wherever we physically are. So just because they're not violating a law doesn't mean they get a pass, right? And so a lot of the reporting is focused around that category, like our South Dakota reporting. I mean, these people weren't violating any clear law, but the whole reporting raised the question about, is this the kind of money that the U.S. wants to be accepting? So I agree with Kevin that transparency is the solution to a lot of this. The Cayman Islands in 2023 is going to go to a public registry of these entities, who's behind them, who's benefiting. And you can bet that already, and up until that date, you're going to see a lot of offshore beneficial owners and companies fleeing that jurisdiction for more permissive jurisdictions.
Flip side of that, if I could jump in, is that, the industry is trying to build a better mousetrap, and you see that through the foundations and trusts, and they're looking for new mechanisms. This is real technical, but there was something called bearer shares, where if I had shares in a company, but I didn't want my name attached, I'd give it to Ziva, and I'd say, hold this for, a period of 10 years, and my name never is attached. And it's a way of kind of hiding your ownership of something. That was banned. Panama is the last place to fully do away with them. But then they're creating these foundations that sound like a charity organization, but they're not. They're complex foundations that add layers of nominees and, fake countries and companies in three different locales. And they create all this obfuscation. So the industry's response is to try to make a better mousetrap, not to open up.
Kevin Hall is a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter and North America editor for the Organized Crime and Corruption Reporting Project. Kevin is overseeing the Pandora Papers investigations in the U.S., Canada, and Mexico. Ziva Branstetter is the Washington Post Corporate Accountability Team Editor. She led dozens of Washington Post journalists working on the Pandora Papers investigation. And if you have any questions or comments for our guests about what the Pandora Papers reveals, if you've read any of the pieces, what stands out for you, and what are your thoughts about what should be done about this? You can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Since we talk about poverty and inequality regularly on this show, before we dive in and talk specifics, I just want to ask both of you about how these findings really exacerbate inequality around the globe. Last year, the UN reported that inequality is growing for more than 70% of the global population. We know that it's really bad in the United States and is continuing and really horrific in so many of these countries where people have just obscene amounts of wealth. Ziva, what would you say about that? When you think about the basics, it's like, how does a society function? How do things get paid for? Well, it's taxes, obviously. And when you have so much corruption and so much obscene wealth, people in just impoverished countries are really hurt the most by all of this. So can you talk about that and connect those dots?
Yeah, the offshore world allows the very wealthy to sort of hide their wealth, avoid taxes, in some cases evade taxes, which is a crime. Avoiding taxes is not a crime. And we had one of our stories looked at billionaires on the Forbes list, and it turns out that billionaires are a tiny portion of humanity, of course, but more than 130 of them, conservatively, who have appeared on the Forbes list of billionaires turn up as owners or beneficiaries of offshore assets. There's about $25 trillion or so of wealth, it's been estimated, in the offshore system. And when you see estimates of wealth inequality, those estimates don't take this wealth into account. So the offshore system really exacerbates the issue of inequality. Our reporting focused on countries like Jordan, where King Abdullah has spent $100 million, more than $100 million on luxury properties in the last 10 years during a time when Jordan, which is a poor nation in terms of the Middle East, was receiving billions of dollars in U.S. aid. Now, the palace says that money was the monarch's, it was not tax money, but it still raises a question about countries in which the rulers live very well, are able to stash their money offshore, able to buy, you know, $20 million French chateaus like the Czech prime minister. And many people live in a, you know, in poverty.
Right. Right. And you have a piece, while his country struggles, Jordan's King Abdullah secretly splurges. The monarch has spent more than $100 million on lavish homes in the United States and Britain. Kevin, what would you add?
Well, we one of the stories we did focused on Gilbert Bigeau, who's the one of the wealthiest guys in Haiti. And we thought that he was very much in the news. And as we were looking through the Haitians in there, we thought he would make an interesting profile because he, we know we've had this terrible assassination of the president. Jackie Charles of the Miami Herald has been practically living in Port-au-Prince these days. Real complex, the earthquake that followed, just a terrible situation. And Mr. Bigeau is reportedly a billionaire. He's never quite commented on it, but it begs the question, how do you become a billionaire in Haiti? They have the IMF puts them at the bottom three in terms of tax collection. He's got a residence on the most prestigious part of Miami, Indian Creek Island, which you can only get there over a bridge into a gated community with 24-hour police presence, which is kind of ironic given Haiti's situation, and lives in, you know, has French dual citizenship as well. Not clear where he pays his taxes, but the Pandora papers made it clear that he had, I think on my spreadsheet, I had 20 companies spread across offshore locales and some that were physical companies like in Barbados from a Texaco concession. But he touches everything that goes into Haiti, whether it's oil, whether it's foodstuffs, whether it's cement products and steel, and even built a private port. I'm sure if he would talk, he would probably say he's done great things for the country. And you have to recognize that he has built in a country where nobody has been able to. But still, that much money and no clarity on where he pays his taxes, how. And I'm pretty sure Haitian authorities aren't aware of all these different things that then pointed to Switzerland, bank accounts in Switzerland, Miami, to kind of a circuitous route from Miami to Switzerland. And it kind of, this is where the Pandora papers are so useful in being able to show how they're structuring their businesses so that they're offshore, they can't be taxed, it's not clear where they get taxed. And if you think Haiti is going to go after that money and then say, well, you can't come after me because I'm actually a, you know, a Panamanian company, and Panama gives 15-year things on tourism, which is not applicable here. There are all kinds of ways to just simply not pay taxes.
The piece that you wrote with your colleague, Jacqueline Charles, about Bigeau, I mean, this was a really lengthy piece. What has been the reaction specifically to this information? And what, if anything, can be done about this? And to also get answers to the questions that you raised that you still don't have answers to at this point.
Yeah, ultimately, the answers are with the tax authorities in these places, right? The other long we did had to do with the Trump Hotel in Panama and the gentleman who made headlines around the world when he kind of outmaneuvered Trump and got his name taken off the building and everything. No one had actually taken a look at him. And it turns out, well, his family is involved in golden passports, invest in Cyprus and get a passport. And then he's nobody in Panama, and suddenly, you know, acquires the most high profile hotel. Who's he done business with? Nobody knows that. Well, the Pandora papers pulled that light back. Was anything illegal? I don't know. You know, it's up to the authorities to decide that. And where is he to, you know, where is he claiming his taxes? In Cyprus, in Miami, in Panama, in the British Virgin Islands? Hard to tell.
And also, I mean, Kevin, when you look at someone like Bigeau to try to get these answers, I mean, and when you're talking about a place like Haiti, thinking about local journalists to try to get answers to questions like this, that's also a challenge, right? Because if you have, I mean, I'm not sure what the situation is like for independent journalists in Haiti, but when you have a country where, for example, you do not have a free press, how do you get answers like this? How do you let the people know that this is actually happening?
Well, the irony is that Bigeau also owns a weekly news magazine as well. But it'd be interesting to see if he writes about himself, whether they write about their owner. But in all seriousness, the independent press is very challenged there. The free press, foreign press, is very challenged there. It's a tough place to do business, to get information. The oligarchs, the people who've grown rich over the years, are believed to be the money behind people's rise and fall in the political spectrum. But again, how do you prove that? Where's the, you know, how do you, my sense is a lot of the economy is a cash economy as well. So how do you, you know, how do you find out how money is spent? One thing the Pandora Papers don't show is the bank accounts. You know, if you had the bank accounts, that would be a completely different story. You'd be able to then see, you know, this company, this shell company, attached to this bank account, which sent this much money to, you know, Antigua or Barbuda, you know, any of these smaller islands where they have tiny little banks that are part of this. So it's a very difficult nut to crack.
Well, you can find that story and more at yourcallradio.org. We're going to take a quick break. Today, we're talking about the Pandora Papers, which exposes a shadow financial system that benefits the world's most rich and powerful and fuels inequality around the globe. Kevin Hall is a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter and North America editor for the Organized Crime and Corruption Reporting Project. Ziva Brandstetter is the Washington Post Corporate Accountability Team Editor. Ziva led dozens of Post journalists working on the Pandora Papers investigation. And after a break, we'll learn more about one of the Post piece called Bitter Sugar, how money has flowed from the sugar fields of the Dominican Republic to the burgeoning tax haven of South Dakota. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today, we are continuing our conversation about the Pandora Papers. This is a massive trove of documents exposing a shadow financial system that benefits the world's most rich and powerful. Today, we're joined by Kevin Hall, a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter and North America editor for the Organized Crime and Corruption Reporting Project. Ziva Brandstetter is the Washington Post Corporate Accountability Team Editor. Ziva, before we dive in and talk about the Dominican Republic, I also wanted to ask you about the fallout from the pieces about King Abdullah in Jordan. Earlier this year, there were a number of protests in Jordan. A number of people were arrested. And a lot of people on social media, when the Pandora Papers broke, were talking about King Abdullah and the $100 million homes that he bought in the United States and the UK. And your team reports that between 2014 and 2017, companies associated with the king spent $70 million on three adjacent homes overlooking the Pacific Ocean in Southern California near Malibu. One of them has 7 bedrooms, 9 baths, has a gym, a theater, an outdoor spa. Can you just tell us, do we know where this money came from and who was involved in buying these homes?
Yeah, our colleague Greg Miller and Paul Sonny worked on the foreign sort of side of the stories that the Post ran, and Greg's reporting on the King of Jordan's offshore companies showed that he had spent more than $100 million on the luxury homes in London and Malibu overlooking the ocean, and basically hidden these transactions through a network of offshore accounts. There was even a reference in the files on a spreadsheet from one of his financial handlers to the property and quote unquote, you know who. And there were a couple of references like that, and clearly a reference to King Abdullah. And, when we approached the palace about our findings, there was no denial or anything like that. It was more of a claim that this is not, none of these expenses have been funded by the state budget or treasury, is what the palace said, and that there was nothing unusual or improper with the king using his own money to buy these lavish residences. Some were like very close to Buckingham Palace, obviously very expensive real estate. But, you know, you have to ask that the king and his financial handlers surely knew that these files had a reason to expect these files to be secret and to be private, not to be exposed to the world. And yet they're even within these secret communications, they're referring to him as you-know-who. So they took great pains to keep the ownership trail hidden. And there was no, it was not like an embassy or a flag or owned by the Jordanian, by the country. It was, you know, in his name alone. So, readers can draw their own conclusions, but we thought that it was newsworthy, especially given the poverty in Jordan, especially given the billions in U.S. aid that that country receives.
Exactly. Kevin, the Post reporters point out that, you know, unlike other countries in the Middle East, like, for example, in Saudi Arabia, the Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman once reportedly spent $450 million on a Leonardo da Vinci painting that he displayed on his yacht. But Jordan, like Ziva said, is one of the poorest countries in the Middle East. It has no significant oil and gas reserves. So can you talk about what is involved in following the money when a country like Jordan received $1.5 billion from the United States alone last year? How do we know how this kind of money is dispersed?
The simple answer is we don't, right? I mean, that's the problem. And it's, you know, Jordan's a great example. It's an ally, and it's a country that we've depended on for quite some time. So I suspect there wasn't a desire to treat him harshly internally if there was knowledge about this. But then take a country that's more hostile, like Venezuela, you know, and the money, how much money we spend, whether it's drug interdiction, whether it's foreign aid for neighboring countries, and think of all the ways that taxpayer dollars go to work ostensibly to boost our national interests around the world that are eroded through this theft and graft. And ultimately, we've spent a lot of time, money, and bloodshed on terror, anti-terror financing and anti-terror efforts. And this, you know, works against that as well. The one thing that we have done pretty well is follow the money on terror groups. There's been a tremendous emphasis at the Treasury Department on that. It hasn't extended into other things like, you know, drug enforcement, corruption, and, you know, and the Pandora Papers show that.
And can you also, Kevin, tell us a little bit more about some of these offshore companies and, you know, what message was sent to them, if any, from the Panama Papers? For example, Trident Trust comes up a lot. Trident Trust has operated since the late 70s in offshore havens, including the UK, the British Virgin Islands. And you all report that Trident set up 84 companies in the British Virgin Islands for the circle of the president of Azerbaijan.
Yeah, Trident was involved in a number of stories that the Pandora Paper partners wrote about. Trident, the actual ownership of Trident is pretty unclear. And they didn't respond much to a request from partners for comment either on specific cases or writ large about the offshore world. They basically said, you know, we have reason to believe that this is stolen information. You've had knowledge of stolen information. And, you know, those kind of letters we got before the Panama Papers as well. Ultimately, not much is known about Trident. It's a little bit more mysterious than, say, Al Quajal in Panama, which the founder, Jaime Alemán, was a former ambassador to the U.S. His father was a former ambassador to the U.S., politically connected, part of kind of the elite ruling structure that's ruled Panama since the return of the Panama Canal, modern Panama. And so in each case, each of these providers have their own kind of story. Trident was one of the tougher ones to crack because, again, their ownership, they I think they've said, and Ziva can step in here and correct me, that their partnership, they're kind of a partnership and they don't disclose the partners. So they kind of operate almost kind of like in the private equity world where we're a limited partnership, but we're not going to tell you who our partners are. So very much, very little known, but yes, they handled all kinds of money in the, from that part of the world that you cited. Also involved in something as simple as Julio Iglesias' fortune as well.
What can you tell us more about Julio Iglesias? And of course, he's the famous singer. I had to laugh because my mom loved Julio Iglesias back in the day.
Well, that might have had something to do with why we did the story. We thought your mother and many other mothers might be surprised.
She actually saw him in concert.
So I think a lot of people, Julio's real estate prowess had kind of been known in Miami, particularly Indian Creek. His islands had been, his properties on Indian Creek Island had been well known. What wasn't known was the extent of the other holdings he had. And he's actually a really interesting example. He's got in the Pandora Papers, they have a Spanish passport for him. He's declaring his residency in Punta Cana in the Dominican Republic. He's got, by our count, roughly 20 properties in Miami, and didn't want to answer where taxes were paid, you know, where things were constituted. His wife is Dutch, and she's on a lot of the documents as well. So, you know, I think it surprised a lot of people in Miami that he would be have that much property and that much high-end property. Nothing illegal about it per se. It's up to the tax authorities to say whether that's the case. In his case, one of the other interesting factors is if you're a non-resident alien in the United States, there are some reasons with the estate tax that you may want to have an offshore, because if you die and you don't have an offshore and you just have a property in the U.S., your estate tax can be as much as 40% of the estate. And if you're an American citizen, you know, you've got exemptions and thresholds and things that help you some. So I think there probably were some legitimate reasons why structuring that might have made sense for tax purposes. Then the next question is, you know, where and how are you declaring your taxes? And that's the stuff that none of us know. And it, in a perfect world, tax authorities would do their job, but we all know that's not a perfect world.
Right. Also, circling back to Trident Trust, they have offices, an office in Sioux Falls, and that's also connected to the bitter sugar piece. So let's spend some time talking about this incredible piece. It focuses on a Dominican sugar company called Central Romana. Most of us have probably never heard of this, but Central Romana makes a lot of sugar that people in the United States use. And Ziva, as your team reports, the once vice president of the Dominican Republic, Carlos Morales Troncoso, was also once the president of operations for Central Romana. And his wealth, including shares of Central Romana, sits in trust set up by his family in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, which is just incredible. So can you tell us more about Troncoso and his relationship to Central Romana and why his wealth is being stored in South Dakota, of all places?
Sure. Yes. So to back up just a little bit, the Pandora Papers files had a records of about 200 U.S.-based trusts that were linked to 41 countries. And nearly 30 of these trusts held assets that we found in our reporting were connected to people or companies who had been accused of fraud, bribery, or human rights abuses. Most of this was in vulnerable countries. And so we focused on several anecdotes in our reporting, including the Central Romana sugar operation and Troncoso. And Carlos Morales Troncoso led this massive sugar operation for about 8 years, but he remained one of the industry's most vocal supporters after he became the Dominican Republic's vice president. Later, he became ambassador to the United States and a foreign minister. And what we found in the Pandora Papers files were trusts that had been set up by him and family members that were originally in another tax haven and that were transferred to Sioux Falls, South Dakota in 2019. It's about $14 million of shares, direct shares of Central Romana. It's very unusual because most of the Pandora Papers files don't tell you exactly what is in some of these offshore vehicles. But in this case, we knew we could draw a direct line between the wealth created by this company for the daughters of Carlos Troncoso and Troncoso and some of the conduct of the company. It had, for example, bulldozed and properties and evicted families, about 60 people or so, in 2016. They lived on property that was adjacent to the sugar plantation. There's been a lawsuit filed over this. The families were sort of rousted in the middle of the night. Whether or not it was their land, it was, human rights advocates say, not a humane thing to do. There was no warning. And the UN had asked some of these folks to testify about that. There have been many complaints of worker exploitation, especially with respect to Haitian workers at the plantation over the years. And that have been confirmed by investigators for the U.S. and others. And so these were multiple sort of findings of, I guess, what you anyone would call bad conduct on the part of this company toward its workers and towards people who lived in the community over many years. And the wealth that flowed out of that company ends up in a South Dakota trust, very secretive, benefiting the daughters of this former vice president of the Dominican Republic.
The four daughters are dual U.S. citizens, and they declined to answer questions about why the trusts were established in South Dakota. They said they were never involved in the operations of Central Romana.
They did say that. They were led some kind of committee that apparently benefited or sought to benefit the workers of Central Romana. They had some level of organization of involvement. But, you know, we're not saying that they or even their father did anything illegal. It's important to note that. It's just a question of how much due diligence should an American trust company in South Dakota be doing with regard to the money that it is accepting and frankly keeping secret. You know, transparency, it always goes back to transparency. And, you know, our investigation found that not only, you know, that family's money, but the money from a Colombian textile magnate who had been caught in a money laundering scheme. There was an orange juice mogul who settled with authorities in Brazil for colluding to underpay farmers. So there were people like this who had been accused or their companies had been accused of bad behavior, allowed to secretly store money in South Dakota trusts. And it raised the question of how much due diligence should be done, how much transparency should there be. And it doesn't create jobs or wealth for South Dakota. It created a few hundred jobs. So what is the trade-off there in terms of the ethical trade-off?
Kevin, you want to jump in?
Yeah, you want to jump in the money. And I wanted also to clarify something earlier that just to make it clear that the Washington Post was the lead partner on this. And if anyone had the impression that I was in charge of North America for this project, that's not the case. I am in charge of it for my company now, but not for this project. The Washington Post has been the lead. And I think their South Dakota story shows both that money is behind this. There's no effort for them, right? It's very similar to what Nevada and Wyoming had done in the Panama Papers. It was free money. They didn't have to do anything. They just hung up a shingle. And I think that's part of the answer in South Dakota. Ziva, would you agree that, there's no why not do it? Even if it doesn't create jobs, it brings in revenue, right?
Right, exactly. Yeah, I mean, the cool thing about this project was just the incredible partnership between all of the organizations and having people like Kevin, who have been there during the Panama Papers, understand the games that are played in this space is very helpful to us. So, we really couldn't have done this reporting without that kind of wisdom. And, the South Dakota reporting just showed that this state has become one of the most secretive tax havens in the world, really. It rivals the secrecy that is allowed by offshore tax havens that our country lectures and says, hey, get your act together. You know, don't hide money for sort of people accused of bad conduct. We need to sort of clean up our own act first, is what many of the experts told us.
Has South Dakota Governor Kristi Noem commented on this yet? As of October 4th, they were not returning the Post's request for comment.
No, we haven't heard any comment from Kristi Noem. There is a lawmaker that we cited in the story, Democratic not lawmaker, has sort of waged a very lonely quest he's a former South Dakota State Senator Craig Kennedy, to wake people up in that state about what was coming. You know, he had some very prescient warnings back in the day when they were considering changes in their laws and to say, like, we shouldn't just rubber stamp everything this industry wants. And he is was glad to see our reporting kind of aired this issue. And, you know, then Congress on about a week ago reintroduced legislation called the Enablers Act, I believe, to crack down and close some of these loopholes. So it's possible that there will be federal action that will address some of these issues.
Kevin, what are your thoughts on the Enablers Act?
Don't have very well formulated thoughts other than it's so hard to get things through. Part of the issue is lawyers write laws for lawyers. I think that's kind of the what's been happening. And while we've had incremental changes, everything's welcome. The one that just passed after almost 6 years is I guess eye-opening in that it shows how the simplest things take that much time to get changed. So I think that would be my caveat, that hope for the best, but realistic that lawyers tend to water things down to where, you know, they're doing somebody else's bidding, basically.
Right. I also just wanted to elevate a couple of the voices in the piece, the incredible piece, Bitter Sugar. Maria Magdalena Alvarez says, I want to tell the North American people that the sugar they consume is bitter sugar. We learn from this piece that workers say they earn about $125 a month cutting sugar cane, well below the country's average monthly salary of $777. Most are migrants from Haiti. And one worker interviewed in the piece, Eli Justin, said he's been struggling in the sugarcane field since 1973 and became blind after a sugarcane pierced his eye. So I really hope you can take the time to check out all of the pieces, but also this one. There's interactive audio, really incredible interviews with people who are directly impacted by this company. I just want to ask both of you, we don't have time to take these callers, but we have callers and people emailing with really basic questions. Will there be any consequences for all of this? Is anyone going to, in one caller's words, get in trouble? Kevin, what are your thoughts? Or Ziva, go ahead.
I just quickly, and then I want to hear Kevin's answer. There have been investigations launched by at least 8 countries, and I think more. There is impact happening. You know, it took several years in the Panama Papers for example, the Pakistani prime minister to be removed. So, you know, it's not going to happen automatically. But Kevin, what do you have to add to that?
Yeah, I think there are tangible changes in certain countries. I think one of the more interesting stories that probably didn't make it much on the English side, but the Colombian Minister of Customs, Customs Chief, had a shell company, and he claimed it was for doing a master's degree in Miami. And then they found that the shell company pointed to another shell company in the UAE, Dubai. There is likely to be consequences for him. I think a lot of the Latin American countries will definitely have consequences. People will lose positions. In the U.S., less optimistic. It'll be very interesting to see how the Post's reporting on the trust changes things.
Well, and don't forget the museums. I mean, we are interested to see how the museums respond to our reporting on the Cambodian relics.
Well, we are going to continue to follow this because these pieces are just so important. And huge thanks to you and your teams for your great work. Kevin Hall is a Pulitzer Prize winning reporter and North America editor for the Organized Crime and Corruption Reporting Project. And Ziva Brandstetter is the Washington Post Corporate Accountability Team Editor. Kevin and Ziva, thank you so much for joining us, and thanks for your work.
Thanks for your time.
Thank you. And you can find more information about the Pandora Papers at yourcallradio.org. Now we want to give you just a quick update on the people versus fossil fuels. This week, thousands of people are taking action at the White House. They're participating in civil disobedience, and they're demanding that President Biden choose a side, people or fossil fuels. Led by indigenous water protectors, activists, and tribal leaders from across the country, hundreds of people took part in a protest at the White House yesterday, which was Indigenous Peoples Day. And according to the Indigenous Environmental Network, more than 135 people were arrested. The police also played that piercing sound that is designed to disperse protesters. Indigenous women and grandmothers were also arrested. And this morning, they were back at it. Here is sound from this morning's action in front of the White House.
Attention, this is Lieutenant Swope of the United States Park Police. Because you are in violation of regulations applicable to this area under DC Code 22-1307, prohibiting crowding, obstructing, or incommoding, you must leave the White House sidewalk now by using the available exit to your front and to the park. All persons remaining are subject to arrest. This is your second warning.
And that is sound from this morning's action in front of the White House. About an hour ago, the Indigenous Environmental Network posted that 155 people were arrested outside of the White House. Again, Indigenous women, grandmothers, and people in wheelchairs were arrested. They say that white allies were not met with the same violence Indigenous peoples were met with on Indigenous Peoples Day. We are going to cover this on Thursday's Your Call. Again, it's a week of action. People from all over the country have traveled to Washington, D.C. to demand that President Biden choose a side, people versus fossil fuels. They are also still demanding that President Biden shut down Line 3, although the company Enbridge on Friday, last Friday, said that that pipeline is now in operation. So you can find more information about what is going on in D.C. Again, they were met with a heavy presence and that piercing noise that is intended to disperse crowds. And a lot of people are comparing the response to mostly Indigenous people peacefully protesting to what happened on January 6th. And we will cover this on Thursday's Your Call. Thanks to Leah Cesarine for producing today's show. Thanks to Kevin Vance for engineering the show. You can find Your Call, sign up for our podcast at yourcallradio.org. You can also leave a review for us on iTunes so other people can find us. And you can interact with us and find out what's coming up on Twitter. We're at Your Call Radio. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. Thank you.